Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. Where are you speaking to us from today?
Well, same as last time. I'm still in sunny Florida. The weather has improved somewhat, and I'm in South Florida, Jim, and thanks for inviting me on.
Well, unlike L.A. and even San Diego, which got snow, I'm sure your weather is much better than the West Coast.
Well, you know, that's all part of that global warming thing, and we should be expecting more snow in places like L.A. if the warming trend is going to continue.
Rick, inflation seems to be on top of everybody's minds. They're telling us if you think inflation is bad now, just wait. It's going to be hyperinflation, double digit for a long time. What's your take on inflation?
My take is pretty much opposite all the take of people who are writing books on it and out there blathering about, you know, inflation, you ain't seen nothing yet. Everybody's got it wrong, just about. Prechter is maybe the only guy out there who seems to understand. He wrote what I consider the Bible on deflation. He took time to understand it better than anyone else. There are a few people out there with a high profile that understand it as well, although they don't write about deflation as I have for the last 30 years. Lacey Hunt is one of them. I think Miss Shedlock is another, and there are a few others, but I've really sort of taken it on as a crusade because the books are wrong, and the high profile guys out there on the lecture circuit who have just written books about, you know, the coming inflation or hyperinflation, they've got it all wrong. So everybody who reads these books and listens to these people are expecting inflation to get worse. And although that may be possible with the consumer inflation, we're going to discover that the consumer part of inflation is insignificant. It's nothing. It's not even a drop in the bucket compared to the deflationary juggernaut that is just sitting out there waiting to implode.
With yes, consumers, we know grocery prices are absolutely unreal, and they're telling us, oh, there's going to be a drought here, and it's going to get worse. So people, of course, if you don't have food, you're not going to live very long. But you're thinking about your economic health. What would cause deflation to happen, and how soon will it happen? How soon would it get its hand around the neck of inflation right now?
Well, hypothetically, I'm going to use the most likely thing. It's not necessary. There are 100 episodes that could trigger a deflationary collapse. But to take what I would consider the one with the greatest odds, even though it may not work out that way, it will be the collapse of the Illinois state pension system. And nobody would deny that Illinois is headed for a crack-up. You could say the same about New Jersey and 22 other states, but let's just take Illinois because they're deepest in the hole. It appeared that they weren't as deep in the hole over the COVID period, where the government was sending checks to everybody and all the states were quote-unquote flush with cash, but that was just a transitory illusion. We're back to actuarial assumptions of 8% returns on pension money, and we know that that's unsustainable. All right, so we take the collapse of Illinois' pension system as a given. Now, we've seen how the Fed works, creating the illusion of wealth with credit inflation. And it's very easy for them, as we understand, to inflate asset prices. It's the stock market gets pumped up and real estate gets pumped up when the Fed eases, especially over very long periods, like what you can imagine the effect in real estate. All right. So that's the easy side of inflation. But there's another side that's not just difficult, it's impossible to achieve. And let's take this state of Illinois thing. All right, let's say that they mail out checks every month to 300,000 retired state employees. These are people who held state jobs. And the same thing could be said at the county level and the city level. They all mail out checks to retirees. And when the system fails, everyone will say, well, the federal government would bail them out, right? Well, I always tell people who use that word government in that context to substitute taxpayers, because there is no government that does bailouts. There's only taxpayers. And the bailout can be done with real money or fake money. Real money would be the government taking on the task of sending out those 300,000 checks every month, making sure the recipients get them. And that's real money. That's not BS money that you pump into real estate and the stock market. Those are actual cash money checks that get spent on groceries and medical bills and everything else. So again, put aside this idea that the quote unquote government's going to be sending out those checks. If it's real money, it's going to come from real you and real me. And you can imagine from a political standpoint how long that could go on. And the difficult thing is that when Illinois starts sending out these checks each month, the 22 other states that are in nearly as difficult straits as Illinois are going to come to the quote-unquote government and say, well, where's ours? So there you do have the potential for an actual hyperinflation. If the government said, okay, well, we're going to bail out New York and New Jersey and California and Pennsylvania and all the other failing state pension systems, then that's a hyperinflation, because there's no way they could tax that money out of us to achieve transfer payments of that size. So in that case, if you do in fact have a hyperinflation, what is the ultimate result? Well, in 3 months' time, the $1,800 check that went out to the Illinois retiree won't even buy a bag of groceries. We'll be off and running into hyperinflation. There's only one place to go from there, and that is to a deflationary collapse where the checks stop going out. Because, well, you know, we ain't got. So even in that very, in that one instance where you could conceivably trigger off a hyperinflation, it would kill itself. It would be self-extinguishing in a matter of months, and we'd be back to a deflationary collapse, which is essentially waves of bankruptcies that sweep over the economy and wipe a whole bunch of zeros from the macro ledger. So that's how it works.
In a deflationary scenario, what happens to the money that you had in the bank or invested and you were relying on for your retirement?
There is no money. And even though we are ostensibly a wealthy country, less so visibly anymore, you know, because let's say the public space has been is in a state of wreckage. All right, but everything proceeds from something that C.V. Myers, in his book, The Coming Deflation, that has a 1976 copyright, I believe it was, the simple statement is, in the end, every penny of every debt must be paid, if not by the borrower, then by the lender. All right, and one way we can look at that that unsettles a fallacy that's very popular is, let's take the student loans, which amounted to something like $1.8 trillion. It looks like the Supreme Court's about to kill quote-unquote forgiveness. But in that instance, you know, we talk in the popular sense, the populist way, about either forgiving or not forgiving, but it's not really forgiven at all. Every penny of that $1.8 trillion is going to be paid by the lenders, by the bondholders who put up good, real cash money to send all these kids to school so they could get their art history degrees and never in their lives have a means of paying back what they borrowed. But again, every penny of it's going to be paid by the creditors. And to take it into the real estate inflation, in the 2007 and 8 collapse, we had this idea that, well, homeowners who were underwater could simply leave the keys in the mailbox and walk away from the debt. Well, the homeowner may have avoided debt, but the bondholders didn't, all right? And so every penny of the forfeit mortgage was paid by the lender. In this case, the actual payment mechanism got muddled because the government came in a big way with bailouts. And the bailouts essentially were just a hugely inflationary way of postponing the payment of those mortgage loans. You know, so we pushed it, we kicked the can down the road a little bit, but of course, every time you do that, you inflate the asset base, the stock market and the real estate market, but it leaves the debt unpaid. And so that's where we are. We've sort of pumped real estate to a higher level than it was in 2006, but the debt that's backed by this hugely hugely inflated real estate, it's going to be paid in a deflationary way. In other words, through bankruptcies and financial events that wipe all those zeros off the books.
In other words, what we saw happen with crypto and NFTs, where people were paying extraordinary amounts for pictures of smoking monkeys, and now they're worth virtually nothing. Is that going to happen to real assets as well?
That was a wholly different, it's unrelated. That was just speculative fraud in an isolated market. You know, it was just, it didn't involve a lot of people relative to the people who were immersed in real estate debt, either as borrowers or lenders. So, cryptocurrencies were just kind of a one-off event. Since I never pass up an opportunity to diss crypto, nothing changed really. The crypto was never worth anything. It looks like it's gearing for a second round. I've written extensively on why crypto is rallying, but, it's not going to end well. But, anyway, crypto is very different from real estate inflation and asset inflation. It is asset inflation, but in this case, there was no asset.
And with crypto, it's been creeping up after they hit about $16,000 for Bitcoin, but it's stuck around $24,000, $22,000. Is it going to get worse?
Well, I don't want to waste too much time talking about crypto, but it has trapped a lot of very, well, what you'd call the smart money. The smart money bought into it, and they're very together, really, in not weighing down bids too heavily. You know, whenever crypto could go $10,000 either way, and it wouldn't mean anything technically or even fundamentally, and that's where it is right now. It's opportunistically treading water, or let's say hovering in thin air, waiting for the next opportune environment to take it $4,000, $5,000, $8,000 higher. And even the big guys who are trapped in crypto know that if they take it up to, let's say, $40,000, there's not much buying. There's no bids below that. You know, if it should start to come down, they won't get to hit many bids. So what they're doing right now is just sort of laying on a little bit of supply each time it pops to a higher level. But it pops purely on not even a short squeeze. It's really just the would-be sellers all kind of sit back and say, well, there's no point trying to sell it up here. They'll have a better opportunity to perpetrate crypto fraud if the cryptos, if Bitcoin hits, and this is just a figure I'm pulling out of thin air. It's what I imagine. If crypto gets to $45,000, there'll be enough suckers out there convinced that at 15,000, they were thinking, just give me 20,000 and I'll get out and I'll never do it again. But if they can jack crypto to around 40, maybe 45, the imagination is going to, the greed and the speculative imagination will mutate somewhat so that there'll be enough people in crypto thinking, hell, why sell here? You know, this thing's going to 500,000 or new all-time highs. And that will create some genuine bids. Although, let's say they're not going to be very reliable if the environment turns against crypto. And crypto, when I speak of the environment, it's simply a function of how much speculative buying is still getting coaxed into the stock market. All right, crypto is opportunistic of moves of periods when the stock market itself is rallying.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, in a deflationary scenario, is there anything you can do to protect yourself? Would gold be a good asset to hold?
No. I mean, gold's always going to be good. I think it's going to hold its purchasing power relative to any other class of investable asset. But don't count on gold being exchangeable for food. It certainly not in the favorable way that most people who bury doubloons in their backyards seem to imagine. As far as a strategy, I like my friend Charles Hugh Smith's Plan C. You know, Plan B is, well, put in a supply of canned foods in your pantry and make sure you have a supply of fresh water and some sort of fuel so that you can cook. But his plan C is, maybe I need to move somewhere that where it's easier to be self-sufficient on the shelter and the food part of your needs. So he moved to Hawaii and he's cultivating a garden that is not just to look at or even to eat, subsist off of, but he's trying to grow foods that are high in nutrition. I think he mentioned breadfruits at one point, so he's really literally getting his garden, cultivating his garden for a day when the economy that we enjoy with delivery of fruit from New Zealand on a weekly basis to your local grocer is not possible. And so I think self-sufficiency, more than any category of investable I could suggest to you, is really where you want to be.
Well, I think of all the lawn space around my own individual condo tower, that easily could be community garden space. Because yeah, nobody lays out on that lawn to tan because it rains so much here.
Well, it will be at some point, but it'll be a while. Even in places like San Francisco, I know my brother lives in a neighborhood that's got sort of a co-op garden there, and it's not, I don't think it could support the neighborhood if push came to shove. It might support just a few people. Some grow plants that are nice to look at, and others grow, yeah, you know, some mostly vegetables, but it's going to be very difficult to convert the urban space to a growing space. And we're certainly not going to do it hydroponically with all these deserted office towers that take up a lot of city space.
I was just going to ask about that. Could they be convertible into what they call vertical farms?
No, because, you know, we've already seen what it cost to grow marijuana hydroponically. Just renting a warehouse space that's appropriate for that use is tremendously expensive, suggesting that growing space, indoor growing space, is at a premium. It's just, there's just not enough of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do have a cousin in Britain that converts cargo containers into fish farms / vegetable farms. The fish waste is used as fertilizer to grow vegetables as well. But again, that works for a restaurant, not for an entire neighborhood.
Right, right. And that's worked out its own economies of scale that happen to be, you know, it's doable for the growers, doable for the restaurants. But, of course, restaurants are going to have their own problems in very hard times. They're just not going to have they're not going to be doing brisk business as they are now.
What's going to happen with all this vacant office space? Vancouver apparently has the most office vacant space in the country because they're continuing to build new office towers with new tenants ready to sign a lease for it.
Well, that's a one-way problem. It's never going to get any better. And if you look, we've talked about this before, how New York, above ground, at ground, and below ground, is an unmitigated disaster in the making. You know, when the office towers get deserted, people don't come back to work. And it's no longer strictly a debate about the habits of workers and the laziness of young people. You know, they don't want to come into the city to go to work. It's worse than that. It's the digital model, digital business model that has supported huge, huge towers. And, you know, just look at, if you visited the Salesforce building in San Francisco, you know what a monument that is to digital wealth, which is greatly inflated. We've seen how greatly with the rise and fall of Twitter. You know, Twitter could easily be run with 20 employees. And that's, I think, true for a lot of it's true for at least a few companies up in the $1 trillion-plus valuation category, that there's nothing really there. So to the extent that they occupy a lot of, you know, urban real estate, office towers, the towers will never, ever, they'll never have tenants again. I mean, they're slowly going to go into, I don't even know what you could use them for. We really haven't reimagined cities in that way, but they're going to be mostly empty and increasingly empty as the years go by. And of course, that means that at all the ground level amenities, and I'm talking about everything from, hot dog push carts to concert halls, they're going to fall into decline and then ruin over time. And, of course, the underground amenities, the subway systems, will be underused. And you have to sort of play that forward to understand that most of what they take in, income from subway tokens, goes to paying not just for the transit infrastructure, but also the $90,000 package, that's healthcare benefits and retirement benefits and everything else, of the few remaining humans who dispense tokens from behind those bulletproof glass windows. So the subway system has its own retirement plan liabilities, and once you've abandoned the subway system and no longer run it because you can't, you're just losing money every time you turn on the lights, you still have those pension obligations. I don't know the number of retired transit employees New York is sending checks out to every month, but it's a big number.
Hmm. Well, Vancouver's rapid transit system, SkyTrain, has been operator-free since it went online in 1986. There are no drivers.
And isn't it amazing how the costs keep going up and up and up? Well, it's really because of the retirement plans and maintenance too. But of course, you can see that they haven't been going overboard with the maintenance of any city transit systems. They all look like hell. And you know, in the case of systems like BART, it's not just the appearance; it's a dangerous way to travel.
Yeah, and again, without drivers, Vancouver's subway system hasn't had any fatal accidents. People do jump in front of the train, but because the train's a robot, it can actually stop faster and react faster than a driver can. The only accidents they've had have been on the switching yards where drivers move the trains around instead of the computer.
Right. I mean, it's... you wonder who's in charge. I go sailing occasionally with a guy who flies the transatlantic routes to South America for one of the big airlines, and he said that there's no question the technology is already there to have pilotless planes. We're still debating whether we should let the airlines dispense with the co-pilot, but in purely technological terms, the airlines are capable of dispensing with the pilots. And of course, people are uneasy enough when the co-pilot's not there. But just for the record, planes can fly themselves already. Mm.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Certainly not the stock market. It's become we're most surely in a bear market, but it's really bearish humdrum because we haven't had that crucial turn, a change of mind, really, on the parts of the portfolio managers, because the bear market's not really going to unfold in earnest until they wake up some morning and speaking of their portfolios, think, oh my God, what have I done? But we're not there. The market can just kind of stumble along right now, but the movement will be primarily down. I mean, we are in a bear market, and we're seeing most recently a situation where the rallies are not surpassing previous peaks, and this is somewhat unusual. From an Elliott wave standpoint, or even from with the technical method I use, that we're not getting impulsive rallies. We're just getting failed rallies that fail in kind of a place so obvious that I don't even recommend shorting it. I mean, you're always looking for the little head fake to take you above previous peaks when you get short, but we've been, those of us who've been looking to get short on every rally have been fooled because the rallies have not done that nasty little trick of just marginally taking out a previous peak. So the bear's there. It's there every day, really, when you watch it and you see that it springboards off oversold lows achieved overnight. And what's happening, it happened today and happened like 30 of the last 31 days, is that you sell the market, the boys pull their bids overnight, and the market gets sold out, and there's no sellers are depleted when the opening bell rings, and so stocks, the broad averages, index futures have nowhere to go but higher. But let's say the question of how higher is not being the answer is not very satisfying. We're getting a lot of failed rallies. So just keep your eye on the ball here. Don't let anybody talk you into the idea that, well, maybe we're not in a bear market, that the economy's going to recover and everything will be all right. That's not going to happen. It will just look like it could happen at times.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me on, Jim. It is always a pleasure.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.